Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This week on the podcast, everything you ever wanted to know about ABBA winning the Eurovision Song Contest 50 years ago with the brilliant ABBA historian Carl Magnus Palm.
Eurovision was certainly a part of his scheme in trying to make Björn and Benny well known as songwriters, primarily. Those three syllables that he knew, you know, he knew that he wanted something there. That's the title. That's where the title needs to be. And then he found Waterloo. We're going to wear these crazy costumes. We're going to make a splash. Our conductor is going to dress up as Napoleon.
Now, please subscribe. That helps me. And it will alert you when anything new comes up on the channel. And as I've said before, I'm trying to create an eclectic mix. So there's something for everyone. Carl Magnus Palm, welcome yet again. Thanks for joining us. This time it's a really interesting moment in history that we're going to talk about 50 years ago. First of all, where were you on the 6th of April, 1974, in the evening?
I was sat in front of my television, together with my mother and my father and maybe one of my sisters, I don't recall exactly, watching the Eurovision Song Contest, as we always did.
Back then, it was a very exciting evening, and it was a very exciting evening for ABBA because they won. So we're going to talk about ABBA and Eurovision this time. This is exclusively what it's about, looking at before Eurovision and looking a little bit after it as well. Now, Benny and Björn's association with the Melodie Festival, which was a sort of prequel, the first round in Sweden before you go to Eurovision, was actually back in 71. What happened that time?
Well, in 1971, you know, they had a songwriting partnership together with Stig Andersson, who was, you know, would be ABBA's manager and was their sort of partner. And he wrote a lot of lyrics for their, particularly the Swedish songs at the time. And they submitted a couple of songs for the 1971 Melodifestivalen. One was Välkommen till världen, Welcome to the World. And the other one was Det kan ingen doktor hjälpa, which, you know, loosely translated as there's no cure for that. And they were both rejected. The first one of them became quite a big hit in this country with there was a female performer called Lil Bubs who recorded it. But, the selection jury didn't like it.
Did Stig Andersson have a specific goal at that time? Was it to try and move his writers and polar music in some sort of international way?
Yes, indeed. I mean, he had when Bjorn and Benny became like a regular team, because they first met in 1966, wrote their first song that year, but then it took until I would say 69 until Bjorn and Benny really decided, okay, we're going to work together, we're going to write songs together, that's what we're going to do from now on. And Stig could tell immediately that the songs they were writing were, you know, they're great. I mean, there's nothing, you know, they're just as good as what they're doing in other countries around the world. There's no reason why this shouldn't be internationally successful. And Stig was quite ambitious. He thought there must be a way to make this happen. So Eurovision was certainly a part of his scheme in trying to make Bjorn and Benny well-known across the world as songwriters primarily, not necessarily as performers, but songwriters.
Because the next year, they entered again, but with a Swedish language song with a singer called Lena Andersson. So how did that fare?
Well, it finished third in Melodifestivalen, the Swedish selection. So they finally got a song entered into this competition, but it only finished third. What was interesting, though, was that domestically, it was the biggest hit in Sweden out of all the Melodifestivalen entries that year. So it was quite clear that they were writing songs that the general public liked, regardless of what any jury thought about them.
Do you know why they didn't continue with Lena Andersson? Because she went on to have quite a successful career, I believe.
Yes, I mean, she'd had a breakthrough in 1971, and then they wrote this song for her in 1972. I think the reason was that by the next song, their next entry, they had their own group, because Bjorn and Benny and Agneta and Annifrid, as they were called at the time, they started recording in the spring of 1972, around the same time as the Lena Andersson Melodifestival entry. So they had their own outlet for their future songs.
And this was Ring Ring.
This was Ring Ring, which was the 1973 entry. And you know, I mean, this was such an important recording in the history of ABBA, an important song, because it was the first one where they really tried to be experimental in the studio and made this kind of wall of sound recording that was quite unusual for Swedish, you know, in Swedish terms, it was quite unusual. And also it was super catchy. It was really, I mean, the moment you heard it, you realized this was a hit. And indeed, they were the favorites to win Melodifestivalen in 1973. Everyone thought they were going to win. But they didn't.
I mean, because they didn't, it does, and they'd gone through this process two times before. Why do you think that they really realized this and continued this route? Because these are quite, you know, you have steps, you get knocked down, you have another step, you get knocked down. Not everyone continues. It does appear that they had a lot of confidence that they were at one point going to break through.
Well, they did, especially Stig Andersson had a lot of confidence that, you know, this is gonna happen sooner or later. And the reason they persisted through Eurovision, because that was, you know, their avenue, basically. I know he was very angry after the failure of Ring Ring to win. You know, he was hot tempered, and he said, you know, we might never go, you know, this is the last time we're in Melody Festival and we're not going to be in this, you know, this expert jury decided that we were not going to win and we clearly had the best song and blah, 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 blah. But I'm sure he cooled down like an hour after he'd said that. And also with the success that they had with this song in Sweden. I mean, Ring Ring was the biggest song in Sweden in 1973. That was when they decided, okay, this is not just about Bjorn and Benny as songwriters. This is, we have a group here that's really popular, and this is what we're going to do henceforth.
So tell me about how Waterloo came about.
Well, they were again invited to submit a song to Melodifestivalen, and they were recording an album at the time. The group was Bjorn and Benny were writing songs, so they went out to this house in the archipelago that they had to write, where they often would write songs, and they wrote a number of songs there, and one of them was Waterloo, and they felt, well, you know, this is a real hit, this is probably the one we should submit to Melodifestivalen, because this has potential beyond anything to do with Eurovision.
I mean, they were really building their sound at that time. You know, you talked about Ring Ring and how that was the sort of wall of sound and the start of what we really know as the ABBA sound. What additional elements do you feel there were in Waterloo that were really developing into what would be the long-term ABBA sound?
It was maybe like a development of what they'd sort of discovered through doing Ring Ring. It was, in a sense, it was more of the same. These forceful, energetic female vocals, you know, harmonies, stacks of harmonies, and of course, Benny's Rachmaninoff piano playing and things like that, you hear that in Dancing Queen, a variation of it. I mean, you could say that. So yeah, it was just refining the formula, if you will. Yeah.
What about the image? Because one of the big things about the Eurovision performance for people watching that time was this was a group that looked different to all the other groups that were on Eurovision, yet it sort of lent itself to what was trendy at the time, glam rock.
Absolutely. I mean, they looked outrageous. I mean, they still, when you look at those pictures, you feel they look outrageous. But certainly in terms of Eurovision at the time, it was just tuxedos and evening dresses, or, you know, unisex costumes, you know, velvet, things like that. And then ABBA come with all these, you know, glitter and platform boots, and it's blue and it's silvery and it's, you know, it shines, and Agneta has this weird hat, and it's just so absolutely they were taking inspiration from glam rock. If you look at a group like The Sweet, for instance, in how they looked in, you know, 1973, more like, then you can see, okay, well, that's where ABBA got their inspiration, probably, or much of it anyway.
In terms of the music, I'm going to be talking to Jana Schaefer, I think he was on about 74 ABBA tracks, I can't remember. He did write and tell me, and it was an enormous amount. And I just wondered how much contribution he and other musicians had in ABBA's music, particularly in those early days.
Quite a lot, I think. Janne himself says that, because he was there from the start, you know, he was there when they recorded People Need Love, the first ABBA song. And he was there on their last album as well, the final complete album they ever made. So he could see the development from start to finish. And he says that in the early days, it was much freer. The musicians could make a larger contribution and come with more ideas. And you can hear that on early ABBA albums. You know, you had like jazz rock influences and stuff like that that you never heard once they'd sort of settled on what they wanted ABBA to be. I think Janne was the one who wrote the bass and guitar riff that goes on throughout Waterloo. You know, ding, doom, doodly, doom, ba-doom, doom, doom. Well, not exactly those notes, but you know what I mean. And he also, I think he also tuned down the guitar and the bass tuned down so they could reach a lower note and things like that. And I also, my understanding is that the guy who played the saxophone on this on Waterloo, which was turned out to be his only ABBA session, he apparently arranged. He sort of wrote that saxophone arrangement. So that was his idea, his contribution.
Waterloo, was it written originally in Swedish and then they made different language versions? Or how, you know, where did the lyrics come from? What languages was it written in? What the hell is it about?
Yeah, I think it was first, it was originally, the lyrics were originally written in Swedish, but only because they needed Swedish lyrics to be in Melodifestivalen. And I don't think that was, you know, that was not the primary, those weren't regarded as the most important lyrics, let's put it that way. And at that time, it would be, if it was like an important song, and this would be an important song because it might be their Eurovision entry, or... whatever, Stig Anderson would say, okay, I'll take charge of this, and they would be happy to let him take charge of it. So he was looking for the perfect title because he knew he needed something that would work in many languages, you know, like Ring Ring. Everyone knows what that is. You know, even if you're Japanese or if you're German or if you're whatever, you know what that means. And Waterloo, at least at the time, was regarded as a kind of internationally well-known concept. The Battle of Waterloo in 1815, Napoleon did surrender, as the lyrics had it, and it was a, you know, great victory in those wars back then. So, and then meeting one's Waterloo became a concept, a symbol or a simile for defeat, basically. So he was looking through this book of familiar quotations to see if he could find something that would fit those three syllables that he knew, you know, da-da-da. He knew that he wanted something there. That's the title. That's where the title needs to be. And then he found Waterloo. Okay, so what do I do with that? Well, it has to be a love song, obviously. So someone is giving in, giving up, you know. It's a persistent suitor. And I, similar to Napoleon in 1815, I have to accept defeat and give in. But that was the rather strained, maybe, concept. But it worked because maybe people didn't really listen too much to the rest of the lyrics. They were just happy to, you know, wow, 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 Waterloo, you know, and that was enough.
So there was a deeper metaphor about a relationship. So in a sense, this is also what ABBA is extremely well known for, eventually, that there's always seems to be some sort of, I don't know if it's always direct, but there's always some sort of metaphor for relationships within their music, which is something, of course, that touches everyone. I want to just talk about your book before we go on and we go back to Eurovision 50 years ago, because I've been watching your posts and your book's in and it looks like it's selling really well. First of all, then, how is it going?
It is going well. I had, you know, this book took me many, 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 many years to write, and it was sort of funded through crowdfunding. So by the time it was finished, I had 1,500 copies pre-ordered that I needed to sign, and a further 200 that needed to be, you know, just mailed out. So 1,700 copies before the book even existed physically, which is great, of course, and certainly for, you know, kind of special interest title as this is. It's kind of, you know, it's about specific aspects of the ABBA career, if you will.
More with Carl Magnus Palm talking about ABBA winning that Eurovision Song Contest 50 years ago. But don't forget to subscribe. I'm building an eclectic mix of videos on this channel. So whatever you're into, you'll find something. And there are a couple of other Carl Magnus Palm interviews that you should check out. Okay, let's get back to ABBA and, of course, the great ABBA historian, Carl Magnus Palm.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
One of my more recent books is a book called ABBA, The Complete Recording Sessions, which is about ABBA's creativity, basically, how they wrote the songs, how they recorded the songs, the background stories about the songs, everything to do with the creation of the music. Okay, so now you have the music created, but it needs to be released. And that's basically what this new book, ABBA on Record, is about. It's what happened to the music after it had left the studio. Okay, so it needs to be packaged. So what's the story behind all the famous album sleeves? Super Trooper with that circus environment and all that. And what did the record companies do, and what did ABBA themselves do, and what did Stig Anderson, their manager, do to make this music reach out across the world and to sell? And what singles did they pick, and why did they pick Knowing Me, Knowing You rather than another song off the Arrival album? And then how were they reviewed? So I have excerpts of reviews from the time, which are quite interesting to read sometimes, because they weren't all positive, let's put it that way. So there's a mix of positive and negative reviews in there, and then chart positions and stuff like that. Yeah, you get to go with ABBA behind the scenes. You get to hang out with them in the studio, because it's tapes of what was going on in real time when they were recording. So that's really exciting stuff in there. Yeah.
So if anyone wants On the Record, I'm going to post a link underneath, and they can go direct to your website and order it. Well, I wish you much luck with that. I want to get back now, of course, to Waterloo, ABBA, 1974, the 6th of April. Waterloo wasn't, or may have not have been, the entry at first. I read that Hasta Mañana was considered.
That is very true. They had written and recorded Waterloo, or at least the backing track for it, but they also then... this other song emerged that they thought could be a good entry. And what was that? It was Hasta Mañana. It was a ballad. It was kind of mid-tempo ballad. It would have a solo female vocal. It sounded kind of European. So if you go back to the winners in the preceding years, in 1973, 1972, 1971, 1970, they had all been ballads of one form or another, sung by a female performer. So if you wanted to have success in Eurovision, it was kind of, maybe that's what you're going to write, and submit. So they agonized a bit over that, but then they realized, well, that's not really how we want to present ourselves. They loved Hasta Mañana as a song, and I think Björn and Benny still feel that that's one of the few songs from that time that they still like. But Waterloo is what they this is how we want to project ourselves. This is the music we want to show that we're able of, you know, that we are capable of producing. So ultimately, they decided, okay, it's going to be Waterloo.
You mentioned just a moment ago in your book about Stig Anderson and what he did to sort of promote records and everything. And on this, he also was out there early, wasn't he, making sure that this record got known before.
You have to go back now 50 years to 1974 and the early 70s, the first half of the 70s in general, and be aware that Swedish pop music wasn't exactly high currency globally at the time. No one cared about pop music from Sweden, I mean, outside Scandinavia at least, or the Nordic countries. And it was very hard for them to reach out. It was very hard for them to be taken seriously. So Eurovision was really a platform for them. Okay, we're going to have a few hundred million television viewers watching us. That's going to be a good way to make our music known. So, but what often happened with Eurovision winners, or maybe still happens today, I don't know, is that they're kind of taken by surprise. Oh, we won. And they're not really prepared. Maybe the record hasn't been released in all these countries, all these Eurovision-watching countries. And maybe they haven't really promoted it, or maybe they aren't prepared. Stig was, you know, he was adamant that he was going to eliminate all of those problems. So he had ensured that, number one, Waterloo was available in all these countries, or at least most of them, well before the Eurovision Song Contest finals in April. And more than that, he also traveled to some of the more important countries, like the UK, Germany, I think, Netherlands, and a few others. He visited three countries in one day. So I think he visited six countries in 2 days. So just on the plane, do whatever you need to do, next country. And what he did do was he visited these record companies that they had in these countries and said, well, this is going to be in Eurovision. You know, we're going to wear these crazy costumes. We're going to make a splash. Our conductor is going to dress up as Napoleon. And, you know, this is a hit, and make sure that you don't lose this. So when they won in April, it was like pushing a button. That's the simile they've been using. It was like everything was prepared, and it all became much bigger than it would have been if Stig hadn't prepared it. You know, it became one of the five biggest hits globally in 1974. You know, it was Kung Fu Fighting by Carl Douglas, Seasons in the Sun by Terry Jacks, and a few others that were bigger. But ABBA were in the top five, and which was remarkable for a group that not many people outside Scandinavia knew who they were before the 6th of April.
I think what's amazing about this story is, and the way that you tell it, is you really understand the stages and the development and the thinking and the growth to make this finally work. So in a sense, all the not getting further, not getting through the first round, as it were, and all these events along the way, and then, you know, and what they had to do to change it, were the reason why they were successful. Now, you mentioned that when Ring Ring in the Melody Festival, and when that happened, they weren't actually officially ABBA. They were the four of them, but they didn't have the name. By this time, they were ABBA, but what were the roles of Agneta and Anni-Frid?
I haven't spent time in the studio with them in 1973 and 1974. I'm not exactly certain, but I think it's been made pretty clear that they were, they had input, certainly. I mean, Björn and Benny, like you said, Björn and Benny wrote the songs. Björn and Benny produced the songs. They recorded the backing tracks with the musicians. They arranged everything. So it was ABBA was their baby, creatively speaking. It was a Björn and Benny project, ABBA, certainly. But once the ladies were in the studio, they could make a contribution. It wasn't just like this, the, you know, Björn and Benny said, stand in front of the microphone, sing like this. They heard the song and then they could had input. Like we spoke about Hasta Mañana a while ago here. And that's a kind of, well, a famous story is that they were trying to find their way into this song, Agneta and Frida were, and they weren't getting anywhere. You know, should I sing it like this? Should I sing it like that? And then Agneta was the one who found the solution because she was a big fan of Connie Francis, who was, you know, American singer, was big late 50s, early 60s. And Agneta was particularly fond of Connie Francis's kind of the sentimental ballads that she sang, you know, like Where the Boys Are and stuff like that. So she thought, if I try to sing this like Connie Francis, would it work? Would that work? And it did work. And it, you know, that was the key. That was the key they needed to sort of resolve the conundrum of how to perform Hasta Mañana. So certainly they seem to have had input from day one.
So there you are. I think you said you were 9, sitting in front of the TV in 1974. ABBA came on. They weren't predicted to win, were they?
They were not. No, I don't think they themselves even expected to win. I mean, you had Olivia Newton-John with Long Live Love, which everyone thought was, you know, quite catchy. It was kind of what you expected from a British Eurovision entry at the time, if you go back to Boom Bang A Bang or A Puppet on a String and things like that. And also you had Martha McNeil with I See a Star, which is, you know, a fantastically catchy song, and others. I'm not sure I was aware of that. I was just like, okay, it's Eurovision Song Contest. Let's see what happens.
There was a sort of strange voting from the UK.
Yeah, the UK, it was kind of weird because they didn't have that many points to award. So they could only award points to 5 songs or whatever. And the UK jury gave ABBA no points at all. So, well, there you go.
Have any of the bands said they thought it was, you know, planned a fix to try and get Olivia Newton-John to win? Or have they said that tongue in cheek?
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe I think it was suggested to Björn at one time, you know, maybe it was a conspiracy. I mean, historically in Eurovision, there has been things like that. You could tell that the Scandinavian countries tended to vote for each other and things like that. Things like that have been going on, I think. And maybe, yeah, maybe there was some truth to that, but I don't know. But it's kind of funny now when you think about it, because obviously Great Britain is like ABBA's second home country. I think the Brits actually regard Great Britain as ABBA's first home country, in a sense. They sort of made it's ABBA is so much a part of British culture these days.
I mean, you said the song was in the top 5 selling songs that year, but it wasn't, as you told me before, this song, this contest didn't actually make them international long-term stars overnight, did it?
Waterloo certainly opened the door. And after that, I don't think they had many problems or setbacks in continental Europe. You know, it's like they were pretty well established there. In the UK, the situation was quite different. Waterloo was a number one hit. It was number one for 2 weeks, I think, in the UK. But after that, everything they released was like a flop. Or not very successful, at least. And you could see media interest drop and the record company was losing faith eventually. And they were regarded as Eurovision winners. And what do we expect from Eurovision winners? We expect one hit and then thank you, go back to your home country. We're not interested anymore. It was fun to know you for 2 minutes and 46 seconds, but whatever you might come up with after that is of no interest to us. That was certainly the attitude in Great Britain.
I mean, at the 50th anniversary of the actual contest, not 50 years, what we're talking about, but the 50th anniversary of the actual contest, that song was voted the best song.
Since ABBA probably were the best thing, best entity to come out of Eurovision, therefore you automatically think that their song was the best song to ever be in Eurovision. And I would agree with you that there have been many other songs that are probably better than Waterloo in Eurovision, but Waterloo is certainly up there. And like you said, ABBA would go on to make even better songs after Waterloo, that's for sure and for certain.
Is there any rumours of what they might be doing on that night that's coming up, the 50th anniversary of Waterloo's win in 1974?
Well, their official spokeswoman, Jørel Hanser, she says that they're not going to do anything. They're not going to be seen anywhere or do anything or celebrate it publicly in any way. So we'll see. Maybe they'll show up, you know, because there are several events, several sort of special nights going on in the UK on that night. And not least the 25th anniversary of the Mamma Mia musical. So if they'll show up anywhere, my bet is that they will be there. Well, not the entire group, but maybe Bjorn and maybe Benny. I don't know. I'm just speculating. I have no idea. I have no inside information.
What about you? The 9-year-old was sitting in front of the TV in 1974 watching this. Had a massive impact on your life because your life has revolved around ABBA, writing so many books about ABBA. So what will you be doing on that night? And how do you reflect on that day long ago when you watched ABBA for the, well, it wasn't for the first time, but when you watched ABBA on the Eurovision and they won?
Going back to 1974 and watching it, I do remember it really well. I do remember it. Sweden won. Wow. It was a big deal. But then my interest in ABBA waned quite quickly after that. I wasn't that interested. I mean, I watched the television programs, but I didn't buy their albums. I didn't buy their singles. I was even quite disdainful, precocious 11-year-old going around telling my classmates, but they're nothing, they're not very good, are they? And things like that. So the fact that I'm sitting now, 50 years later, in this position that I've had now for 30 years and doing, it's my job, it's my work in life to write, to research ABBA, to write about them, to do interviews like this and whatever else I do. That's surreal. It's weird. And I can't really understand why and how it happened, but it did happen. And now, obviously, I'm very happy with it because I'm older and wiser. And I really love ABBA's music to death. I think it's, some of the greatest pop music ever made.
Carl Magnus Palm, thank you. I think it's a great, great story because of your own personal story as well that's involved in that. I wish you a lot of success with On the Record, your latest book, which people can buy. They can look at the link below, click on that, and then you can go straight to Carl Magnus Palm's webpage and order the book. But I have a final question. So, Waterloo, ABBA won on the 6th of April, 1974. Who was the runner-up?
It was the Italian entry, C, by, I'm not sure I can pronounce her name.
I wish you well. Much success with the book. Carl Magnus Palm, thank you.
Thank you so much, Steve.
Up there is an interview I recommend. Down there is where you can find all the podcast interviews. And here is where you can connect.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.